Hello and welcome to State of Crime. One state, two murders, lots of crime. With Kaylin and Elena.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm actually really excited for my concert. I know. I just needed I needed a deep breath to get ready.
To let it out? Yeah. Okay. So we're recording this on the back of our last case. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get ahead just a little bit, so we're not as going to have as much, current events as we sometimes do.
Right.
But
None, I guess?
Yeah, I guess like none.
We should have saved some of those for today, but
maybe,
oh well.
But we're really glad that war didn't start with Iran and things like that.
My friend's husband did get sent over, so, and they don't know how long they're going to be gone at this point. Mm-mm. They'll find out in a couple of months.
Yeah.
How long. But it could be he could be gone for up to a year, about a year.
That sucks.
Does suck. But, yeah, so no war so far. I did feel like there was something else that I had seen. Oh my gosh, this is completely, unrelated to true crime, and I meant to ask you this before we started recording, but we're here now, so I might as well just ask you about it now. What were your thoughts on the Golden Globes opening monologue?
You know, seriously, he's done this every freaking time that he's hosted.
Really?
Every time Ricky Gervais is on any talk show, anytime he hosts anything, he's done the exact same thing. I don't understand. And every time everybody's like, oh, it's like with Donald Trump. Donald Trump says stupid, batshit, crazy, inappropriate stuff all the time. Every time he tweets, every time he opens his mouth. And then every time everyone's like, oh my God, I can't believe he did that. Oh my God, did you see this? Oh my God. Ricky Gervais, same damn thing. Go back and look at any of his monologues for the Golden Globes. Any of his jokes. Go on YouTube, look up anytime he's on any talk show. People are stupid.
I mean,
he was funny. I thought he was hysterical.
I thought it was hysterical. It was funny. I think people's facial expressions were even funnier.
True that.
Tom Hanks, he had the best facial expressions. Did. Oh my goodness.
Yes.
He's
so nice. You know what I mean? I do think Tom Hanks is generally a nice person. And so for him to react like that seemed very honest.
Yeah.
I think other people were faking it. Some of them looked nervous.
Uh-huh. Some of them looked fucking terrified.
Yes. His Jeffrey Epstein joke was gold.
It was so funny. They were all funny. The whole thing was funny.
Yes.
If you haven't seen it,
go watch it on YouTube.
Has nothing to do with true crime, guys. Nothing.
But it's awesome.
But it is. And it's the best 8 minutes I've watched in a long time.
Yes.
Because it was hilarious.
Yes.
Anyway, I meant to ask you that before we started recording again. And I didn't. I forgot to. All right. So we are in Mississippi today.
Woo.
And I'm pretty excited about this case. I feel like I did probably some of the best research on this case that I've done in a while.
Nice.
Which is probably just because I haven't been working very much lately and I have a lot of downtime. So today we're talking about 20-year-old Christy Ray. She lived in a very small town in Tippecanoe, Mississippi. She lived with her parents, Mary and Tommy. She was a sophomore at the community college in town, and she had planned on going to Mississippi State after finishing 2 years of community college.
Okay.
So she did all of her basics and stuff at community college and then planned on doing her 4 years at a university. So she planned on going to Mississippi State. She had big dreams and a lot of ambition. She wanted to work with computers. She didn't want to program, but she wanted to fix computers.
Okay.
And she loved going shopping. She was really close with her mom. They'd go shopping all the time.
Which is, I think, many mother-daughter bonding.
Right.
You know.
She did have a boyfriend. He was a year older than her. He was 21-year-old Brian Mathis. And he, too, had plans to go to university. He was doing the community college, too, and then planned on heading to university after that. But he was not going to Mississippi State. He was going to Ole Miss. So they knew that their relationship was either going to end or it was going to have to be a long-distance relationship. And that seemed to stress Brian out a lot.
I don't like where this was going.
You could definitely tell, he could tell that she was much more invested in her schoolwork than, being able to spend their last couple of months together.
Well, and honestly, good for her. Like I said, and I don't care, male or female, do not plan your life when you are 20 years old right. around somebody else.
Right. So it did stress him out a lot, and he did put a lot of effort into trying to spend as much time with her as he could before either they would be breaking up or in long distance.
Right.
And she was working her way through community college and trying to save up for university, not only for college itself, but the living expenses, because with her living with her parents, she didn't have any.
Right. And what year was this again? I'm so sorry.
This was in 93.
Okay.
And so she worked two jobs and went to college. She was a part-time, she worked part-time at a bank, which was the Sunburst Bank, and that was the same bank that her mom worked at. And on the weekends, she worked at a video store.
Okay. I miss video stores.
And one of the documentaries I watched said that one of the FBI agents that worked on this case said that there had been some indication that someone had been looking into her routine and keeping a close eye on her. Mm. Now, when he said this, I was kind of annoyed. Because why are you going to pussyfoot around it? Like, yeah. She was being stalked. Stalked.
See, and that's the other thing. I just feel like so often, and we've talked about this a lot, like with the Women Count on Facebook, mm-hmm. She does a great job of taking those sorts of statements and headlines and things like that that happen in these reportings
right.
that do always try to minimize the perpetrator's role and what they were really doing.
Right. Like, don't pussyfoot around it. Yes. She was being stalked.
Yeah.
Like, plain and fucking simple.
Yes.
Anyway, so on January 29th, 1993, Christy and Brian had plans to go to the movies that evening. And earlier that day, around 12:30, Christy gets to the Sunburst Bank for her shift. Her mom is also working that day, and they both got off at the same time. The bank closed at about 5 p.m., and they left at about 5:15 p.m. They said goodbye to each other in the parking lot because Christy was coming from school, and her mom, Mary, was already at work when Christy got there. So they said goodbye in the parking lot. Her mom had to stop by her dad's house, so Mary had to stop by Mary's father's house. He had just gotten like cataract surgery, and she just wanted to make sure okay. that his dinner and stuff was ready for the evening. And Christy had told her mom that she had plans with her boyfriend that night, and she wanted to go home and freshen up instead of stopping by to see her grandpa. So Christy gets home, and she is the first one home, and when she gets there, she finds a masked man waiting in her bedroom for
her.
Oh
my God.
And there's a struggle. He attacks her. And she puts up a hell of a fight, ends up getting out of his grasp, runs to her parents' bedroom, locks the door, and is trying... She's going through her parents' dresser drawers because she knows her mom has a pistol in there. Well, the locked door didn't hold him back for very right. long. And he is able to actually get control over her, handcuffs her, and gets her out of the house. And puts her in her own car and takes her car and they leave. And her mom said that she hadn't really been feeling well that day when she left her at the bank. And so she wanted to call and check in on her. And so she was, she called at about 6:45 to check on her. And when there was no answer at home, she decided she was going to go. She was going to go ahead and head home, make sure she was okay. It's not a very long drive home. It only took her about 15 minutes to get from her dad's house to her own home. So she arrives at about 7 p.m. and she notices that Christy's car is not there. But when she got inside, she noticed that Christy's purse and her scarf and the rest of her things that she would take with her on a regular basis was still where they were at the home on the table. And that's when she knew something was wrong because as most women,
right. You never leave
the house
purse.
Without your purse. Cause right. your purse has everything you could possibly mm-hmm. need in it.
Right.
And next to the purse, she then notices a note. And this note was a ransom note. And along with it, it said that it also contained a crude map. I don't know what that means.
So, well, crude matte means that it's a matte, but it's like drawn very poorly.
Oh, okay. And it said, quote, there will be a red flag somewhere on this block. Tuesday, 12 midnight, $15,000 in gym bag or she dies. No police.
Okay.
So this part is a little strange to me because finding this note, my first thing, call the police. That's not what Mary does first. Mary first goes to Christy's boyfriend's house.
Okay.
See if he's there because she did say that she had plans.
Right, to go with
her
him.
Boyfriend.
Yeah.
She checks the boyfriend's house. She's not there. She then goes, because it's a Friday, she then goes to the video store to see if maybe she was working or picked up an extra shift or something like that, which is strange to me because you have a ransom note. So why are you checking other?
But she might be panicking, thinking this can't possibly be real. I think that's the biggest thing, is people think this can't be real. I need to make sure these other things
are, yeah.
Yeah.
So when she checks a couple of places and cannot find her, she goes back home. And she notices that both Christy's room and her own room seem to be very trashed. You could tell there had been a commotion.
So she hadn't even, like, checked those first. She just grabbed the note. Yeah, this tells me she's not thinking. Do you know what I mean?
She said that Christy's room, there was clearly
a struggle,
a huge struggle. And then in her room, she had seen that the drawers had been gone through. And so her mom said, like, she was looking for the gun. Mm-hmm. She knew I had a gun in there, and that's what she was looking for. And she also noticed how the intruder gets into the home. Christy's screen on her window had been cut open.
Okay.
And on the outside of her window had been stacks of pallets.
Okay.
So that the intruder was easily accessible to get into the home. And that's when her mom notifies the police and calls them and lets them know what's going on. Now, wrong section. So there is a 23-year-old man. We're going to kind of shift gears a little bit. And his name is Charles Crawford.
Okay, so let me ask you something.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to find her alive?
I'm not answering that question yet.
Okay. Okay.
So we find there's a 23-year-old man named Charles Crawford, and he was set to be on trial the following Monday. So just a couple of days after that, he was set to be on trial for assault and rape.
Okay.
And on that same day that Christy disappears, Charles' family finds a very similar ransom note in their own home.
Okay.
And this scared them, and they said that they believed that he was planning on or had already kidnapped somebody when they found this note. Now, we don't have exactly what this note said.
Okay.
Because this note was first taken from his family's house to his attorney, because he had an attorney for the upcoming trial.
Right.
So they took it to his attorney and was like, we found this. We're nervous.
Okay.
And the attorney then takes it to police, and now police immediately have their main suspect.
Uh-huh.
You've got two ransom notes.
Right.
And he's already about to be on trial for...
Right, he's setting this up, right? He has kidnapped her to do whatever. We already know he's going on trial for rape and murder.
Right.
And this is his way of getting out of it.
Right. So, the next day, on Saturday, January 30th, 1993, Charles was caught.
Okay.
He was on his ex-father-in-law's property, and he was taken to the command center that had been posted for the investigation. FBI came in the same day she disappeared.
Right, because that's...
Right, it was an immediate thing, and they had set up a command center. I believe it was at one of the elementary schools in the small town, which I think is strange that they... I don't know if it's just to, like, stay, like, under wraps. Nobody would think to go to an elementary school.
And what day is it?
It's a Saturday.
Okay.
Saturday, January 30th.
So school would have been in session. Like,
on a Saturday?
Well, no. But I mean, just in general. Right. You know what I, and I know they need a command center because you need room. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To spread out. But okay, just keep
going. I don't know. The elementary school for me, that was just like, kinda it was unusual. A strange thing. Yeah. And I don't know if it was just something that like makes it less known that they're there.
Well, no,
like,
everybody knows they're there. I mean, and you have to for me, it's space, having enough space.
Yeah. And I guess in such a tiny town, that probably does have the most space. So he was caught on January 30th, and he was taken to the command center that had been posted for her investigation, and he spoke with Joseph Jackson, who was the agent in charge of the FBI operations in Mississippi. He was then interrogated with Joseph Jackson along with two other FBI agents. There were three agents and then Charles in the room. Now, early in the interrogation, Charles said that he hurt his back hunting. It was also noted that while they were in the car, he was read his Miranda rights while they were in the car, and he told them that he thought his leg was broken, but he didn't want to go to a hospital.
Okay. And so, as one does.
They were like originally going to take him to the hospital.
Right.
And then he was like, I don't want to go to the hospital. So they started taking him to their normal, their police station, when then they were informed, don't take him there, take him to our command post so we can interview him.
And he has a hurt back.
And now he's got a hurt back, yes.
Possible broken leg, hurt back.
Right.
Go.
But doesn't want to go to the hospital.
Doesn't want to go. No.
No hospitals. So the agents let him lie on his back on the floor, like flat on his back, to alleviate whatever kind of pain his back's in right now. And he denied having any involvement with her. He denied knowing her personally other than just like seeing her around town. And he tried to come up with like an alibi saying that he had hurt his back hunting, that he was out there because he was hunting. Uh-huh. And then Charles was asked if Christy was still alive. And this is kind of when he breaks. And it said that he immediately started sobbing, saying that she was no longer alive. And he soon would agree to take investigators to her body. And this interview, interrogation, whatever you want to call it, lasted only about 20 minutes.
Oh my God.
So he broke quick.
Yeah.
And Christy was found at approximately 9:48 p.m. on Saturday, January 30th. She was approximately 400 yards from an abandoned barn, and that abandoned barn was on his ex-father-in-law's property, but with it being a big property, it was just kind of like out. It was abandoned. Nobody used it. Right. It was just there. And the officer raked leaves back and uncovered Christy's body. He found her hands were cuffed behind her back around a small cedar sapling. There was a sock that was stuffed into her mouth, and a gag was around her head to keep the sock in place. She had not been blindfolded. Her jeans had been pulled down below her hips. And Dr. Stephen Hain, who's a pathologist, he testified in the trial that Christy had suffered a single stab wound to her chest. Mm. She had multiple abrasions all over her left, her right and left lower, her legs, her lower extremities, as well as scrapes on the skin on her back and her butt. Which
so he had dragged her.
He had dragged her, yeah. She also had scrapes on her face and chest, as well as contusions on her lips and abrasions on her wrist. The wrist injuries were consistent with her being handcuffed. And the pathologist also testified that the scrapes found on her butt and her thighs were because, while she was alive, he said that it was consistent with injuries a person would receive while engaging in a fight or flight response. And he said that the injuries were consistent with Christy being dragged along a hard surface, possibly with branches or twigs. He said that the injuries were also consistent with those occurring on someone attempting to avoid and resist rape. The abrasions on her face and the contusion on her lip were consistent with her face being pressed against a hard surface as opposed to being dragged. He also said that Christy died from a large stab wound to the left mid-chest, which punctured her heart and her left lung.
Oh, my God.
Causing extensive internal and external hemorrhaging. So she was bleeding out. Mm-hmm. And he said it probably took Christy between 1 and 2 minutes to die. And she also suffered from multiple contusions that measured up to the this one I wrote in quotes because it was something that I couldn't change words around. Mm-hmm. Well, I could have, but multiple contusions that measured up to approximately 1 centimeter, which would be 3/8 of an inch about the anal orifice. So
he had raped her.
He had raped her. All right, so we are going to take a quick break. She had been kept alive in this barn and was killed the same day she was found.
Okay.
So the investigators said that they could easily tell that this was premeditated. He prepared for this.
Right. So he took her there, held her there, raped her, did whatever, and then killed her the same day that he got caught.
Yes, because that day before he had killed her, police had shown up at his ex-father-in-law's house. And he could see them, but they couldn't see him, and he panicked.
Okay.
And there was a stockpile of food and drinks in the barn, and it was said that he was very concerned. This is what he said. This came from Charles himself. So take it with what you mm-hmm. will. And he said that he was very concerned about his upcoming event, the trial, mm-hmm. and that he had considered running away. But he had no money, so he couldn't run away.
So that's why he decided to do the kidnapping plot?
So he also considered suicide.
Which, he should have started with that.
Right, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. Mm-hmm. Can't kill yourself, but you can kill somebody else.
Right.
Fucking douchebag. Anyway.
This is the kind of stuff I just... Ugh.
Right. He stayed at the barn until midday when he left to hunt and hike. After reaching an area that he said he was not familiar with, Charles decided to build a fire, which he soon put out because he was concerned somebody would see the smoke. And then at this point was when Charles claimed to have blacked out.
I love the way they just so conveniently black out before they murder.
Right. He states that the next thing he remembered was being inside of the Ray residence. So he claims that he didn't plan this. It was just like, I was out hunting and I built fire, but I didn't want anybody to see me. So, cause mm-hmm. I have trial in 3 days and blah, blah, blah. And then I black out. Next thing I know, I'm in her house with a ski mask on.
I don't know how it happened.
I don't know. Fuck. And he said that when he came out of the blackout, he heard someone crying in one of the back bedrooms in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Christy was on the floor of one of the rooms with her hands cuffed behind her back. Charles said that he then put the ski mask on so Christy would not be able to identify him.
Okay.
So he, I guess at this point in my mind, now he's claiming that he wasn't even part of attacking her and handcuffing her in the first place.
I just heard, and then, yeah, whatever.
And then I put the ski mask on that I didn't know I brought with me because I was blacked out. Fuck. Like,
So dumb.
And he said that that was when he put the ski mask on so Christy wouldn't be able to identify him. And he asked Christy where the keys to her car were. He stated that he took her, put her in the car, and drove away. He then said that he took Christy from the house because he did not know what he was going to do with her, and he figured it was best to take her with him. He denied writing or even having seen the ransom note that was found by Mary Ray. He said that Christy was very upset when they left her house that Friday night. Fucking duh.
Yeah,
you
no
have
kidding.
Attacked her and now you are kidnapping her. You have cuffed her. And like, of course she's fucking upset, you psycho. Like, what do you think she's going to be like? Oh no, it's totally fine that you just attacked the shit out of me. Now I'm being handcuffed and you're kidnapping me in my own vehicle. Like, what? You don't expect her to be upset about that? Jesus. And He said that as they drove around, they began talking and she started to calm down. He said that they drove around for about 45 minutes to an hour talking to each other. He said that they then abandoned the car and he took Christy out of it. She was still handcuffed. He still had the knife, the revolver, and a shotgun. He claimed... Oh, but he was blacked out, so he didn't, like, bring it anything.
Exactly.
Right. He didn't plan this. He just brought three weapons, a pair of handcuffs, a mask. But he didn't plan any of this, guys. Don't worry about it. Jesus. He said that he removed the handcuffs when she promised not to run away.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them walked back and forth along the Jonesboro Road. And Charles then decided that since it was getting cold, they should go to the barn there to spend the night. This barn that he just so happened to have stockpiled with food.
Food, yes.
And drinks.
Well, he just found that there.
Yeah, it wasn't his. He didn't do that. If he did, he was blacked out when he did that. Yeah. So he, Charles says that as they started to approach the barn, he fell into a sinkhole that came up to his neck. He tossed his shotgun away as he fell, and he claimed that Christy asked him if he was all right, picked up the shotgun, and helped him out.
Aw, wasn't that nice?
Right. Because
that's what you do to your kidnapper rapist.
Right.
Oh my God.
He said that he and Christy had something to drink, they ate some cookies, and then they cuddled together in the barn for warmth, and they talked all throughout the night.
This is so incredibly creepy.
Right. Because you know none of this fucking happened this way.
No.
And, like, I don't know. So... He then said that the next morning on Saturday, he heard a police siren and thought the sheriff's office was coming for him. And they did see that the police had stopped at his ex-father-in-law's house, so he panicked. And that's when he said that she tried to talk him into turning himself in. And that's when he fled into the woods with his shotgun and his knife. He claimed that Christy ran after him in order to try to convince him to turn himself into the authorities. And he also claimed that Christy told him that no one had been hurt and she would help him if he just turned himself in. That he was concerned because he did not know how he was going to explain abducting her. And that he felt low and Christy had more or less convinced him to let her go.
This is just so disgusting.
Right, because he plays this narrative like, I didn't know what I was doing and then I panicked. But she was like super nice about it. And she really wanted me to turn myself in. And I thought I was going to let her go and then I panicked, so I just killed her. Like... Like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
It's also said that at about this time, he said that he had kept the ski mask on at all times, except for when it was dark in the barn, so Christy knew that she couldn't see his face. Now, this is something that nobody really knows for sure, because nobody except for Christy knows that. But... I don't know. I have a hard time saying that he would keep the mask on the entire time. He planned on kidnapping her. He planned on taking her and raping her. Yeah. I think he planned on killing her. So
And here's the big thing. That Monday, he was going on trial for, you said rape and murder?
Assault and rape.
Okay, assaulted rape. So I think I said murder earlier. So he's already been caught.
Right.
And he was getting ready to go on trial. And he just decided, you know what? No, I'm just, and this time I'm going to quote unquote make sure I don't get caught.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that once.
He had been stalking her, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get more into that because we have a little more information on that.
Okay.
But yeah, it's like, I think that once either he got her into the car or once he got her to the barn, I don't think he had that mask on anymore because I think he had every intention on killing her and there's no need for him to have that mask on anymore.
True.
So I don't believe anything that he's saying.
No, I don't either.
You know what I mean? No. And it just doesn't make sense. He said that that was when Christy convinced him to let her go. And so he then took off the mask, and she said that she recognized him as someone that she had seen from around town. This is what he said.
Mm-hmm.
He then stated that as they began to walk back to Christy's car, he gave Christy the shotgun. Stupid. Mm-hmm. He's lying.
Of course.
God, you're not going to give some. First of all, when they found her, she was still handcuffed.
Yeah.
Behind her back. You didn't give her
a
shotgun.
To a tree.
Right. Like, you didn't give her anything.
No.
And he claimed that after he gave her the shotgun, that's when he had another blackout conveniently.
Yeah, these convenient blackouts and, you know, they're friends and.
Right. And that she was, like, totally cool with him kidnapping and raping her. Like, it was fine. She was totally cool with it. The next thing that he says he remembers was sitting on a stump in the woods wearing a t-shirt, blue jeans, and no shoes. He said that Christy was lying at her feet, handcuffed behind her back, dead. He claimed that she was fully clothed with one of his socks in her mouth. Poor girl. He then decided to hide the body and drag Christy by her feet across the ground. This is how he explains that her pants and her underwear had been pulled down and her shirt had been pulled up. Which, please, if you are dragging someone by their feet, their pants are not coming down.
Right.
Their pants are going to be pulled up more than anything else. So, he said that he thought about what he was going to do next. He sat on a tree stump for a while. He said that he couldn't find any place to, like, bury the body. So he just, like, left the body by this tree stump and covered it with leaves and branches and twigs to try to hide it as best he could. He said then he put his boots back on, retrieved his shotgun and his knife, and headed back through the woods towards the Providence Road area. And then he said that he knew people were looking for him, but he did not know why they were looking for him. Because you just abducted and killed this poor girl.
Oh my God. This is just so fucking
ridiculous. Idiot. He's so dumb. He then said that when he neared the Providence Road, he saw a patrol car, so he sat on the hillside so that they couldn't see him. Mm-hmm. And when the patrol car left, that's when he crossed the road into another wooded area. He claimed that he then fell into an abandoned well that was about 10 feet deep, and he had used his knife to dig himself out. And that's, like, how he hurt his back or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't fucking know. He then said that he continued towards the residence of his ex-father-in-law, and as he approached the house, that is when he was caught and arrested. Now, we talked about how she had been stalked.
Right.
And so she did know this man by name.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Charles, but he went by Chuck. She knew him as Chuck. And he was a regular at the video store that she worked at. And it was said that she got the creeps from him for any time she met him. Mm-hmm. It was just a bad vibe. And this was said multiple times. He would come into the store and he would want to go to the porn area. And at that point, it was in, like, a locked room because mm-hmm. it's for
right,
adults only.
Right.
And since she was 18, she was the one that would have to open the door and let him in and wait for him to pick out his video and then be able to check him out and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she also believed to see him, like, she saw him mm-hmm. around. And I think that she knew she was being stalked, but she probably wasn't. She probably thought she was overthinking it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that's something that I would do.
Oh, yeah.
I see someone all over the place, and in my mind, I'm like, they're probably stalking. But at the same time, it's like, you know, probably not.
Right.
Like, it's probably just a coincidence, especially being in such a small town.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is said that this town is so small that you can't really find it on a map. that you just kind of have to find it out for the best, I guess. And it's mostly generations and generations of the same families in this town.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very small town. Now, he did go to trial. He did get charged. His defense clearly was going to try to do the whole fucking insane thing.
Right.
So he did get workups by a couple of psychiatrists, mm-hmm. and he was fit to see trial. He saw trial. He was found guilty of all of the counts, and he was sentenced to death by lethal injection.
Ooh, I like that.
And that was in 94, so it was a fairly quick trial, right. Which is awesome.
Well, there's not a lot here to dispute.
Right. Like, he confessed, he showed him where the body mm-hmm. was. There wasn't a whole lot that he could have done,
right.
or that would have been done for him. Plus, he was also being charged with the assault and the rape that he was going to see trial a couple of days later for. And he did get sentenced to death. He has since appealed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It still has never gone his way. He's still, to this day, on death row, which sucks because you look at it and it's fucking, what, 15, 20 years later?
Yeah.
Because he got sentenced in 94.
But like I said, he was obviously a serial predator killer in the making. He just, we're lucky enough that he's stupid and got caught fairly early.
Right. And you know. Yeah, so, and I mean, I said 15, 20, I just can't do math. Mm-hmm. It was more like 25 yeah. years or something. 25, 26-ish. And yeah, he's just still sitting on death row. He was 23 when this happened. He's currently 50.
So 27 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. That's a creepy, awful, icky.
Right.
Yeah.
And, yeah, no,
Yeah.
Yeah, but, like, I just
And don't. I bet if you, like, really could do a deep dive into this guy's his biography and his pathology and stuff, like I said, he was just a serial predator.
Oh, I'm sure he was. And this one, I'm surprised I got as much information mm-hmm. as I did. Most of my information came from court documents, because aside from court documents, there's not really a whole lot. There's no Wikipedia page on him or her.
Not a lot of report, it's not a well-known case, I'm sure.
Investigation Discovery did put out an episode of one of their shows, which I watched, and that did give me a lot of information. I got, as much as the reenactment and the dramatized parts they're so bad. The acting is terrible. It's just so hard to watch. But with things like that, you do get interviews from the investigators, the FBI agents, the family. And so I do think that they're helpful when doing this research. But, like, don't follow the reenactments at all, because it's just terrible. But other than that, I really didn't have a whole lot of information to go through. Even on, like, Murderpedia, when you look at this guy's Murderpedia, most of the information that you get on there is court documents.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of, I'm not used to having to read court documents. Yeah. They're very confusing to go through. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things where I'm like, I don't know what this means.
Yeah.
Like, you say this, but, like, what does that mean for him? You know what I mean? So I had a hard time. So I'm impressed that I got as much information on this one as I did.
You did great.
I'm pretty impressed.
I'm very impressed.
But, yeah.
And this was an interesting, you know, because my last case had so much stuff out there.
Right.
And then when we hit these smaller cases, but they're just as disturbing. And I think especially that idea of small town, this guy's incubating there. Mm-hmm. And it's just, ugh, mm-hmm. gross.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sad, though.
Very sad. So, ugh.
Mm-hmm.
Now I just feel skeevy and I kind of like, ugh, yeah. But let us know what you think. Join our discussion group. Email us at stateofcrimepodcast@gmail.com.
Give us your suggestions.
We love suggestions. We appreciate all your commentary. And we just want to thank you for listening. And we will
make sure you follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And rate and review us if you have not already. And I think that's everything.
See you next time.